Bonsoir, bienvenue. I'm Antonia Maione, director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, and I'd like to welcome you all here for the 2010 Fulbright U.S.-Canada lecture. As you know, we're gathered here today to hear from Ambassador David Jacobson, and this is, in fact, his first public speaking engagement at McGill University since taking office just over a year ago. And we are all very honored that he accepted our invitation to deliver tonight's distinguished lecture. As many of you in the audience know, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada hosts a major annual conference each year. And this year, in fact, our conference will focus on the Canada-U.S. relationship. It will be held in March 2011 and will feature conversations and relations and a series of conversations between Canadian and American counterparts about particular aspects of the Canada-U.S. Relationship. The goal is for each speaker to discuss how decisions are made vis-a-vis their counterpart, what interests influence their decision-making, and the complexities and challenges of managing this enduring relationship on a day-to-day basis. I'd like to thank this evening our co-sponsor, the Fulbright U.S.-Canada Fulbright Foundation, and Michael Hawes is here this evening. Thank you very much, Michael, for co-sponsoring with us. Principal Monroe Bloom will speak a little bit more about that affiliation in a few moments. But before she does, I want to take this opportunity to thank the Foundation for all of the work that they have done, not only here at McGill, but really in the university community across Canada and the United States. And I'd like to thank the Dean of Arts, who is also present, Christopher Manfredi, for his continued support of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. I'd like to now call Principal Heather Monroe Bloom to the podium.
Thank you, Antonia. Bonsoir, bienvenue, chers collègues, invités distingués. C'est une soirée unique d'avoir l'ambassadeur Jacobson avec nous. It is a great pleasure for me to say a few words just at the opening of this very special lecture, and I want to add my own words of thanks, of course, to Dean Manfredi and to the colleagues at McGill who do such an extraordinary job in promoting the Institute for the Study of Canada, no one more so than Professor Maione herself, who's just been a remarkable leader. I'd like to recognize as well Madame Lily de Grandpré. Where are you? There you are. You're hiding Madame Denise Chung and Alec Patterson. Alec, where are you? Here, founding co-chair of the board of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, and our dear colleague, Principal Michael Goldblum from Bishop's University, also on the board. The Canada-U.S. Fulbright program is a remarkable program in the great tradition of the Fulbright of understanding the importance of having international mobility for people of all ages, but particularly younger adults, and the notion that the Fulbright would embrace the cross-fertilization of scholars from Canada and the U.S. to spend time in each other's jurisdiction to understand better how these close neighbors work together and where we are different culturally, economically, and in other ways, it has been so critical. I had the great pleasure of meeting the current president and founding president, Michael Hawes, back in 2003 when we talked about developing an opportunity for McGill to participate fully, and we have since been great beneficiaries of the exchange of professors and students alike. And so, Michael, it's fantastic that you're here this evening as well as the ambassador to help us open this special lecture this evening. Michael Hawes is a professor in international relations at Queen's University. He has just come off of a one-year, I wouldn't call it a sabbatical because I've seen you in perpetual motion through that period, but in advancing international relations and comparative analyses in American and U.S. Policy at the University of Southern California. He has been longstanding chair of American Studies, the American Studies Association in Canada, and he has brought superb energy, enthusiasm, and dedication to making the Canada-U.S. Fulbright program as dynamic and productive as it could possibly be. And I can't think of any time when it's more important for us as a Canadian institution, if I can speak on behalf of McGill, to be engaged seriously with matters of Canada-U.S. Policies. And so to have both you and Ambassador Jacobson here, and I might add Jeremy Jacobson, who led the way by choosing McGill as his place of study, makes it a very, very special evening. So I think with that, Michael, I'll simply thank you and call you please to say a few words of introduction and to welcome our ambassador. Thank you.
I don't know if I can live up to all of that. That was very charitable. Thank you, Heather. Heather has been an enormous supporter of our program and of me personally. And in fact, there is nothing easier in my job than be a partner to McGill University. I brought with me these 17 pages of individuals in 8-point font from McGill who have participated in our program, almost 100 graduate students, 30 faculty, and dozens of people in various short-term programs. It has been a phenomenally successful and important program. McGill, as you in this room all know, is one of our national treasures, and it is my pleasure to make sure that everyone in my travels knows that. A little over a month ago now, I invited Heather to give one of our lectures. It's our 20th anniversary in Canada. We have a series called Directing the Power of Human Knowledge, and the principal kindly agreed to be one of the speakers in that series. We held this lecture at the Boston College Club in Boston, Massachusetts. You'll all know Boston. It is the home of McGill of the South. Good university town. We had a terrific audience, which included a large number of McGill alum, and I can tell you McGill's reputation and its standing in that community is absolutely flawless for so many reasons, but not the least of which is the leadership of your principal. She was a very impassioned lecturer and gave us a tremendous talk on how and why we should move forward with passion, with vigor, and with focus. It was a terrific talk and did us proud. My job here tonight is equally pleasurable and easy to introduce my friend, Ambassador David Jacobson, who has now been in the job a little over a year, a man of tremendous enthusiasm and good humor. He told me tonight Ottawa didn't have a bad climate. I don't know that I believe that, but it is important. When I have had the good fortune of being in this job for a few years now and have been involved with 3 U.S. ambassadors, all absolutely committed to the job. When Ambassador Jacobson came, there was some trepidation in the building and in the embassy in Ottawa because here was an individual from the private sector, and I'm going to talk about this in just a minute, but not with the same long commitment to public service or elected public service that his predecessors had. It turned out in very short order that Ambassador Jacobson identified his task, embraced his task, embraced this country, and has become a terrific friend to all of us. His goal is to know Canada well, to make sure that the two countries develop a deeper, more nuanced, and more thoughtful relationship, and that we move ahead in what are, without question, difficult times. Difficult times for universities, difficult times for the economy, and difficult times in the political world. This probably won't come as a surprise to you, given that Ambassador Jacobson is from Chicago and was appointed by Mr. Obama, but I think he might be leaning towards Democratic politics. I'm not sure. Ambassador Jacobson was sworn in as the U.S. Ambassador to Canada on September 25th, 2009, so as I said, it's just a little over a year. Just before that, he served as President Obama's special advisor on appointments and spent a little over 8 months in the White House. He is a man with very considerable experience in politics, even though having not held public office, and a very distinguished law career in Washington. The most important thing, again, for us here in Canada is the enthusiasm, the commitment, and the passion that he shows for this job. He is here to help us all move forward and to make sure that this relationship is as strong and powerful as it can be. Ambassador, thank you.
Michael, thank you very much. You and the Fulbright program are great friends of mine and of the embassy and of the United States. Principal Monroe Bloom, I want to thank you for inviting me here today. One of the joys that I have had in the last year since I got to Canada is getting to know you and getting to know your husband. I have, it will not surprise you, a special place in my heart for McGill University. Because my son Jeremy, as your principal mentioned, is a student here. In fact, he's sitting here in the front row, and I am quite sure that he would not want me to do anything to embarrass him. So I promise Jeremy that I will not point out that your mother loves you very much, that she misses you dearly. You know, the last time that I spoke in Montreal was right after the Canadiens had been eliminated from the Stanley Cup. And I had a sad day, I know. I made some complimentary opening remarks about their goalie, Yaroslav Halak. And then 2 days later, he was traded. I hope Jeremy doesn't end up at the University of Toronto before the end of the week, or worse yet, at the McGill of the South. But it is great to be here. As you heard, I have been here for a little bit over a year. I have had the privilege of traveling around Canada from coast to coast to coast. There aren't many countries that you can say that about. Along the way, I have been profoundly affected by the magnificent scenery, by the warm hospitality of the Canadian people, by the alcohol content of your beer, which I might say is especially true here in Quebec. Now, looking at me, I think everybody understands that I am legally old enough to drink it, but the jury's still out on whether I'm up to it. I am pleased to serve here tonight as the speaker for the Fulbright Lecture. And over the last 20 years, Fulbright Canada has awarded academic scholarships to over 1,000 American and Canadian students, and as you heard, almost 100 from McGill. In fact, there are 3 Fulbrighters who are studying at McGill as we speak. In 1946, when Senator William Fulbright devised the program, he had 3 goals in mind. One was to bring a little bit more knowledge to world affairs, a little more reason, and a little more compassion. And those are 3 goals that, as the United States Ambassador to Canada, I share deeply. A few weeks ago, at a dinner we had in Ottawa, I had a chance to meet with a large group of Fulbright alumni. And each of them told me virtually the same thing, that the Fulbright program had changed their lives, and all of them were now changing our lives and really changing the world for the better. It really is an extraordinary program, and it's an honor to be here giving this talk here tonight. I thought that I would begin my remarks this evening talking for a few minutes about the midterm elections that we just had in my country. Now, I don't know how many of you had a chance to watch the returns, I guess 2 weeks ago Tuesday. But on CNN alone, there were literally dozens of analysts who were trying to make head or tails out of what was going on. It is reassuring to know that even in these very difficult economic times, that America continues to lead the world in creating jobs for political commentators. But since the ballots were counted on November 2nd, I have been asked the same questions over and over again. What does it mean? What does it mean for the United States? And most of all, here in Canada, what does it mean for Canada, and what does it mean for the relationship between the United States and Canada? And my own sense is that the results don't foreshadow any significant deviation in the nature of the relationship that we share. Right now, the relationship between our two countries is as strong as perhaps it has ever been. I wish that I could take credit for it, but the credit is, in fact, deserved by the relationship that your Prime Minister and my President have with one another. It is a very strong relationship. But I think more importantly, the relationship that Barack Obama has with the Canadian people, which makes my job a whole lot easier. He has an extraordinary level of approval here. I know that from the polls. I know that from walking down the streets and having people just walk up to me at random and know who I am and tell me how much they like my president. I will tell you, I wish that I could have the same experience walking in the streets of the United States. But the midterm elections are not, in my view, going to change the fundamental nature of that relationship. When the new Congress comes together in January, we are still going to have the largest trading relationship in the history of the world. We are still going to be working together to improve border efficiency and border security. We're still going to be working together on energy and the environment and the other important issues that affect the relationship that we have. Now, that said, there are a couple of things that I do believe that the election may impact with respect to the relationship. The first is that given what I would characterize as the more robust Republican presence in the Congress, that is typically going to be viewed as translating to more support for free trade. And I think you may see fewer Buy America-type bills, Buy America-type legislation that's at least introduced. We had one very celebrated bill in connection with the stimulus, which I spent probably the first 4 months I was here trying to deal with. But you're likely to have a little bit less of that, and that's good. The President of the United States believes in free trade. I believe in free trade. We believe in it not because we're nice, but because it's good for the United States, and it happens to be good for Canada. The wild card with respect to this trade issue is the influence that the Tea Party is going to have, and the extent to which members of Congress are influenced by what may turn out to be their protectionist views of the world. And quite honestly, the jury is out on that. Very few of them have made any real comment on foreign policy and international trade, but you just have to wait to see how they're going to behave once they get there. It is useful to recall, however, that administrations controlled by Republicans and Democrats have uniformly resisted the temptation, or generally resisted the temptation, toward protectionist measures and the desire to isolate ourselves. And I think it's fair to say that we understand that if we close our doors to the world, that the world is going to close their doors to us. And that would be a significant setback to the world and to the United States, because so much of our workforce owes its employment to the access we enjoy to the world's markets. And nowhere in the world is that more true than here in Canada. The second possible implication of the midterm elections is the potential for legislative gridlock. The new Congress has a very important decision that they're going to have to make. Are they going to work in the spirit of cooperation and partnership with the President, or are they going to stand in their way? is this going to be a government of yes, we can, or is it going to be a government of no, we can't? And I'm reminded of when Ronald Reagan was in the White House, and shortly after he got there, he sat down with his speechwriters, and he told them that every single sentence of every speech had to be as positive as it could possibly be. Reagan would not say we must never forget. He would insist on saying we must always remember, more positive. And even in tough times, he refused to say that America faced problems. He would talk about the fact that we had challenges. But if the truth be known, in this time and in this place, I think that even Ronald Reagan would say that America has problems. That we need our elected officials to come together and to work together for a common purpose. And if they do that, then I have every reason to believe that unemployment, slow economic growth, and rising debt are going to be taken care of, they're going to be confronted, they're going to be solved. But if they don't, and we have 2 years of deadlock at a critical juncture like we face right now, that is going to be very bad for America. And given the relationship and the interrelationship between the United States and Canada, no place outside the United States would feel that deadlock more than Canada. The long-standing truth of our relationship is that we each do well when we both do well. Now, I'd like to focus the rest of my remarks on what I see as the most fundamental issues that face that relationship and what have been my priorities over the last several months and what will be my priorities, I believe, over the next several years. And as I see it, there are five of them. The first one is trade, then the border, how Canada and the United States can work together in the world to foster the values that we share, the Arctic, and finally, energy and the environment. And let's start with trade. A lot of American speakers, quote presidents like Lincoln and Roosevelt, that's way too easy. I'm going to quote Warren G. Harding. Now, folks, this may be the first time it's ever happened. You may be witnessing history, so please pay attention. In the summer of 1923, President Harding was on his way home from visiting what he referred to as pioneering Americans who lived in Alaska. And he stopped off in Vancouver and gave a speech in Stanley Park. And he said to Canadians, "So long as each country maintains its independence and each recognizes its interdependence, those paths cannot fail to be highways to progress and to prosperity." Now, events proved Harding right, at least on this one. The rest of his record was not so hot. But our independence has been maintained, and our interdependence has grown, and prosperity has been the reward for both countries. The trading relationship between the United States and Canada is different from the relationship of any two countries in the world. The United States buys and sells things with a lot of countries, probably every country in the world. But the United States and Canada make things together. Our supply chains are fully integrated. It's a mature and it's an interdependent relationship, and one that President Obama and I are determined to deepen. The President has a very clear goal when it comes to trade. He wants to double exports over the next 5 years. He calls it his National Export Initiative. And if we are going to meet that goal, we're going to need to rekindle the spirit and the ingenuity and the entrepreneurialism that made the United States into the world's preeminent exporter. And we're going to have to start it here in Canada. President Obama's National Export Initiative is about encouraging Americans to create and to produce the goods and services that other nations and people want to buy. And it only makes sense that Canada, our largest trading partner, is the logical destination for more exports and even stronger ties. One of the ways we can do that is by promoting greater efficiency in our trade. And to cite just one example, I want to talk about standards, those very slight differences in rules and regulations that significantly increase the cost of trade. I'll give you an example. There are food regulations dealing with fortified foods, and the one that I want to talk about is fortified Cheerios. Fortified Cheerios in the United States have to be produced with a slightly different formula than the fortified Cheerios that they sell here in Canada. Now, I'll tell you something. For years, and Jeremy can attest to this, in the United States, I ate Cheerios that were fortified with the United States recipe. And for the last year, I've eaten Cheerios that have been fortified with the Canadian recipe. And not once, have I felt less healthy or less cheery. But the differences in these standards lead to separate production runs and less efficient trade and higher costs, not only for the producers, but also for the consumers. And it's not, if it was just Cheerios, we'd be okay. But this is replicated thousands and thousands of times. And we're never going to solve the differences in all these standards between our countries, but we do need to focus on finding the common ground where it's possible, and we need to reduce the non-tariff trade barriers, which complicate our efforts to trade with one another. Now, this leads me to my second point, which is the border. The border is a key element in the lives of our two countries and in the relationship we share. President Clinton once described it as a boundary that separates our people, but not our common dreams. Now, I was going to use a second Warren Harding quote, but there isn't one. The border occupies a critical role in the integrity of the security and the strength of our two economies. If we're looking to increase exports to Canada, it only makes sense that we invest in creating a more efficient border. When I got here, I made it a priority to visit border crossings, to customs warehouses, to airport checkpoints. I learned a lot about the flow of commerce, the improvements that are underway, and the challenges that remain. In fact, I spent a number of days, literally, it's the truth, doing nothing but going back and forth and back and forth at border checkpoints. I learned a lot, but I must say I wouldn't recommend it for your next family vacation. But I was amazed at the dividends that are being paid by investments in infrastructure and in technology. September 11th was a game-changing event in my country and in yours. And the fact is that it's taking time for both of our countries to catch up. And those catch-ups are not cheap, but we have made a lot of progress. And one place that I want to single out is about 45 minutes from where we're standing, and that's the new border crossing at Champlain, New York. My country invested $120 million in that state-of-the-art facility, and it is one of the most modern on both of our borders, and it dramatically improves the flow. If any of you have gone there, it dramatically improves the flow of people and goods across the border. But I've learned something else that is even more important than spending more money on infrastructure and spending more money on technology. We have got to change our fundamental vision of what the border should represent. We have to look at it not as our first line of defense, but as our last line of defense. The more that we can move security away from the border toward the perimeter of North America, the more that we can change our vision of how we can improve the efficiency at the border and how we can work together to defend North America, the smoother the flow of goods across the 49th parallel. And the bottom line is this. We do not need to choose between efficiency on the one hand and effectiveness on the other, between the improved flow of goods and improved security. That is a false choice. If we work together, if we're smart, if we're innovative, we can have both. And I can tell you that this is something we are working very hard on and something that I hope we'll have progress to show for. The third important area of our relationship is how Canada and the United States can work together in the world to foster and to protect the values that we share. The United States has many friends and allies around the world, but we don't have very many partners. And Canada is one of the very few partners that we have in that process. When President Kennedy came to Ottawa and spoke before the Parliament, he said that the issues and the irritants that inevitably affect all neighbors are small indeed in comparison to the issues that Canada and the United States face together. That truth, which was so resonant during the Cold War, has renewed relevance in an area in which we confront the menace of terrorism and the challenges of fragile states. Canada and the United States are working together in Afghanistan. We had a lot of news about that, in fact, today. We work together in Haiti. We're working together with Mexico to help solve challenges of violence and chaos. We've been partners in undertakings around the world and across recent history. Last Christmas, I went to Afghanistan with General Walt Natinchak, the chief of the Canadian forces, to meet with Canadian and with American troops. I traveled to Kabul, to Kandahar, and several forward operating bases that were manned by the Canadian and American forces. I saw soldiers from our two countries eating together, bunking together, fighting literally shoulder to shoulder. And I can tell you that they share a sense of purpose and a commitment to making not only Afghanistan, but North America a safer place to live. Now, Canada and the United States do not always agree on every issue of foreign policy, but there exists a bond between our countries and an overriding belief in what we can accomplish around the world as partners and as independent nations. And I can therefore understand the disappointment that Canadians felt when they came up short in a bid for a seat on the UN Security Council. And I can say, in all candor, that the United States would have loved to have seen our neighbor and our ally join the council. Now, as a permanent member of the United States, or the United Nations Security Council, the United States and none of the permanent members lobby for who's going to get a seat on the council. And the United States has had an unswerving policy of never disclosing who we vote for on the council, as has Canada, and as have most of the members. The United States is well aware of Canada's long and proud history of contributions to international peace and security, and we value its strong support for democracy and human rights. And the fact of the matter is that Canada's absence from the Council is a loss to the United Nations. But it does not infringe on Canada's ability to do good in the world, to have influence, and to make a positive difference. Now, the fourth area I want to talk about is the Arctic. There have been two things that have surprised me since I got to Canada. Number one, curling is much harder than it looks. It's true. You tried it. And number two is the importance that the Canadian people attach to the North. There is an emotional attachment that has been forged with your country that is extraordinary. It occupies an important place in the culture and the consciousness of the country. The North is vast, and much of it is desolate, but that is part, I think, of the hold that it has on Canadians. I went myself to Alert, which is as far north as you can go in Canada, and indeed as far north as you can go anywhere in the world. And I experienced that hold myself. There is an eerie calm and beauty to the Canadian Arctic. And given that attachment that the Canadian people have with the Arctic, I am both proud and a little bit relieved to be able to say that the United States does not question Canadian sovereignty in the Arctic. I'll say that again. The United States does not question Canadian sovereignty in the Arctic. Now, the largest disagreement that we have between our two countries in the Arctic is the boundary between the United States and Canada in the Beaufort Sea. And that problem has been around since the 1860s. But even though that dispute is 150 years old, we are making progress on that one. Our country, we are really making progress on that one. Our countries are working together again, not as we speak because it's frozen, but if we had met in July, as we speak, to map the seafloor and to resolve this dispute based on principles of international law. And given the positive working relationship that we have in other areas as well as this one, I'm hopeful that we're going to be able to sort that one out in less than another 150 years. The fifth and final important area that I'd like to discuss is really made up of two separate but very related issues, and those are energy and the environment, and how the United States and Canada can work together to ensure safe and secure sources of energy while at the same time protecting the environment that we share. Now, students and ambassadors have at least one thing in common. We both see way too many PowerPoint slides. Since I got here, I have seen thousands, and most of them are a blur. But I remember one slide in particular. It listed the 12 countries in the world with the largest proven petroleum reserves. Canada was number two. And I got to tell you that the other 11 are not countries that are likely to friend the United States on our Facebook page. That story works better at universities than it does in most of the places I speak. The fact that Canada is by far our largest foreign supplier of every single form of energy, oil, natural gas, electricity, uranium. If there's some other kind of energy, I guarantee you're the largest supplier of that. That is something that my country values enormously. Now, for a long time, the United States has had a very complicated relationship with energy. In the 1920s, Popular Science magazine looked at the future of energy. They weighed the evidence, and they came to an unequivocal conclusion. Declared that the United States held beneath its territory enough oil to meet all of its needs and more for several hundred years to come. Now, it turns out that prediction was off by roughly several hundred years. Today, my country uses upwards of 20% of the world's oil, and we control about 2% of the world's oil reserves, and you simply cannot drill, baby, drill your way out of arithmetic. Energy security is a critical element of United States national security, and there is no place on earth that is a safer and a more secure source of the energy that the United States needs than Canada. At the same time, there is no issue that is more critical to the well-being of the planet than climate change. The United States, Canada, and the rest of the world are moving toward a time of less dependence on fossil fuels and more dependence on alternative sources of energy. But that is not going to happen tomorrow. And I'm not smart enough to know if that's going to happen in 10 years or 20 years or 50 years, but it's going to happen. In the meantime, however, we have got to be responsible stewards of the environment. We have to use the fossil fuels that we need in the most responsible ways that we can. And our job together, the United States and Canada, is to strike the right balance between safe and secure sources of energy and protecting the climate that we share, the air we breathe, and the water we drink. President Obama said on his first trip to Canada that we each have big environmental challenges. The United States has to deal with coal. Canada has to deal with the oil sands. We both have to do more to lessen the greenhouse gas emissions from these sources of energy. And I want to be honest about this. The problem has not been made any easier by the inability of the United States to put a price on carbon. The president has acknowledged that cap and trade is not likely to pass in the next couple of years. And the practical reality is that in Canada, you can't have a system of carbon pricing that is different from the one in the United States. The negative effects on trade, on business, and on environmental stewardship in one country or the other would be very significant. We need to ensure that we coordinate our environmental policies as much as we possibly can in order to avoid dislocation or disadvantage on one side of the border. And we have to work to address this problem. Now, make no mistake, there are going to be fits and starts. We are not going to solve this problem overnight. But I do believe we are going to get there, and we're going to get there because we're going to work together. Now, I want to leave you with a story. And it's a story of something that has happened to me many times since I got to Canada. As you may have heard, when I first got here, I said that I was going to go to all 10 provinces in the first 2 months that I was here. I had no idea what that meant, but I said it on television, and so I had to do it. And because anything you say on television has got to be true. My wife Julie and I spent almost all of our first 2 months traveling around this country. And in every single province, we had the same experience. Sometimes the experience happened once, and sometimes it happened five or six times. And sometimes it was the premier, and sometimes it was somebody that we met on a street corner. But someone would walk over to me, and they would put their arm around my shoulder, and they would whisper into my ear that there is no place in Canada that has a closer relationship with the United States than wherever it was that we were standing. And I say that not to make fun of the people who were talking to me, but I think because it says an enormous amount about the relationship between our two countries. It is as strong and it is as close as it has ever been. It is as strong and it is as close as probably any two countries on earth. It is my honor and my privilege to be one of the people who is responsible for maintaining it and perhaps improving it a little bit. And it is my honor and privilege to be here at McGill, and thank you all very much.
The ambassador has kindly agreed to take some questions. I know it is a proud tradition here to always begin with a student. Student first is the motto and the preference of the institution. And actually, I will encourage people to ask their questions directly and try not to speechify. Any student?
Good evening, Mr. Ambassador. My name is Paul Delplas. I'm a U3 political science student here. And I'd like to touch on one of your priorities, that being the Arctic and Canadian sovereignty. And I noticed that you didn't talk specifically about the U.S. government's policy with regards to the Northwest Passage. And I was wondering if you could specify on the U.S. policy and how that fits U.S. interests.
All right. For all of you who are not experts on the law of the sea, which would have included me up until a year ago, the position of the United States is that because the Northwest Passage connects two oceans, that it is what is called a strait used in navigation. There are a number of these around the world, the Straits of Gibraltar, the Straits of Hormuz, the Malacca Straits in China Sea. And under the law of the sea and convention that dates back quite some time, that when you have a strait used in navigation, that there is something called the right of innocent passage. And what that means... I'm going to bore everyone here, but what that means is if you're going through it and you don't mean any harm, you know, you can't go through and start shooting, but if you go through either military ships or commercial ships and you don't mean any harm, that you have a right to go through and that the country in whose sovereign territory it is has the right to impose reasonable safety and environmental and those types of regulations, but can't stop you from going through. And this is not, it's important not so much because anybody thinks that Canadians are going to exclude the United States, but rather because if we were to agree to the Canadian position, which is that these are internal Canadian waters that they can choose to exclude people from, that maybe some of these other countries that are not quite so friendly might take a position that was adverse to the interests of the United States and to Canada. And that is one where, quite frankly, I think we agree to disagree. Fortunately for the disagreement, I think it's going to be a while before it's going to be put to the test, because it will be a while before ships start navigating through the Northwest Passage. Any others? This is like when I was in law school. Everybody's afraid to ask questions. Except the difference is that when I was in law school, everyone sat in the back.
I'm sitting in the back here.
Okay.
But I'll ask a question nevertheless. Bill Watson in the economics department. The Cheerios problem. Can you give us the solution to the Cheerios problem? Do we accept your standards? Do you accept our standards? We'd be happy if you did. Or do we sort of agree that each other's standards are reasonable and we'll allow U.S. products in, even though they don't conform to our standards, and you'll do the reverse?
Well, first of all, without necessarily singling out what to do with respect to Cheerios, because, you know, we got shredded wheat and we got a lot of them. But here's the deal. There are three kinds of standards differences in my mind. There are standards differences where there is a legitimate, let's call it, scientific basis. There's a reason that Canada has one standard and the United States has another standard. And either there's a disagreement about the science, or there's something about Canada that requires a different state. For example, French language on packages. It's a good example of something where there's a difference. You know, we don't need that in the United States. You do need it in Canada, and particularly here. That's one category where there's a reason for the difference. The second category is differences that are based on, let's call it, protectionist impulses. That it improves the trade position of businesses in the United States or businesses in Canada. And then the third is differences that are just different. And that I think what you need to do is you need to start by focusing on the last category. You need to find the ones where the packaging size is a little bit different. You need to focus on the ones where nobody can really explain why the difference is there. It's just different. And within that group, what you have to focus on are the ones where you're going to get bang for your buck. And one of the problems with this standards thing, and people have tried to address it in the past, and we are going to try to address it again, is that there is no sex appeal to it. It is very much in the weeds. You know, I don't think that most of you wake up in the morning and sit there and go, damn, I wish they would fix the fortified Cheerios problem. But what we need to do is we need to figure out which of those are trivial and don't really matter economically, and which ones we can change that might really matter a lot. For example, there are differences with respect to the seat belts that are used in cars in the United States and seat belts that are used in cars in Canada. Now, most cars, certainly the ones that are made in the Michigan, Ohio, Ontario region, go back and forth across the border on the average 7 times. And if it was ultimately destined to be sold in Canada, whichever side they put the seatbelt in on, they would put in one kind of seatbelt. And if it was ultimately destined for sale in the United States, they would put another kind of seatbelt in. Now, my guess is, I've been riding around in cars in Canada now for a year, and again, I have not felt threatened by your seatbelts. And I suspect that when you all go down to Florida and you rent a car, the first thing that goes through your mind is, oh, my God, I'm going to die because I've got these American seatbelts. I think that is one where there is a significant economic impact, and there are thousands of those. And so it is a laborious process. It is going to require guidance from the private sector as to what's important and what's not important, and it's going to require judgment, and it's going to require compromise. Now, whether the United States formula for Cheerios or the Canadian formula for Cheerios or some other formula for Cheerios is the best one, I don't know. Okay, I'm not the Cheerios. I love them, but I'm not good at recipes. But I can say that it just probably strikes everyone in this room as kind of silly. And what we've got to do is we've got to find the ones that are kind of silly, but that have a big economic impact, and we've got to fix them. And then we have to move to the ones that are protectionist, and then maybe finally move to the ones where there are scientific differences and material differences and see if we can resolve those differences.
Yes, you emphasized that Canada was seen as a partner rather than a friend. Yes, okay. meaning a stronger relationship, yes. Just the friendship relationship. Would Canada not having troops in Afghanistan be consistent with being a partner?
Well, somebody told me don't answer a lot of if questions, particularly an if question that is not going to happen. I don't know if you heard the news today, but today the government announced that they would extend the commitment in Afghanistan from 2011 to 2014 with 950 troops, but that they would not be in combat and that they would probably primarily be involved in training and that they would move out of Kandahar and to be centered in and around Kabul. I think I've got that pretty much accurate. And so I'm not going to speculate on what might have happened if they had made a different decision. That's welcome news. It's a tough fight in Afghanistan. And as I've said repeatedly, and as the Secretary of State has said, and as the President has said, we need as much support as we can get. The NATO coalition needs as much support as it can get in Afghanistan. And I think the one other thing I would say about this is today in particular is probably a good day to reflect back not just on what's going to happen in the future, but on the service and the sacrifice that Canadian men and women have given over the last 10 years, and it has been extraordinary. And you should all be very proud of it.
Ambassador Jacobson, what's the most surprising thing that you've encountered since you've been in Canada the past year? So you're from Chicago. Ottawa's not Chicago. Maybe that's what was surprising.
That's a very good question. I will tell you the most honest answer I can give. When I was, as you heard, before I came here, I was a special assistant to the President in the White House. And I was there from, first I was in the transition, and then I was in the White House, and I always say I went the day after the election. I actually went the day after, because the day after all of us were kind of sobering up. But a lot of champagne. But I was in Washington for a long time, and I knew for a good chunk of that time that I was going to be coming here as the United States Ambassador to Canada. And I took advantage of the opportunity to meet with as many people in the federal government as I possibly could who had issues relating to Canada. I met with virtually every cabinet secretary. I met with many government agencies. I met. And what I heard in almost every one of those meetings was, oh, we got a problem with this, and the Canadians won't listen to us about that, and there's this and there's that. And I came here, honest to God, thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to have so many problems, and, you know, we're going to be at loggerheads about everything. And, in fact, my experience has been very, very different. As I talked about, the relationship is extraordinary. And I do think, I mean, it was a surprise to me how good it is, how close I think the Canadian people feel to the American people, and I will say vice versa. But That has been a very pleasant surprise, and I think that a lot of what I heard when I was back in Washington was predicated on the relationship that our countries had in the prior administration. And without getting partisan, because I am the ambassador to Republicans and Democrats and Sarah Palin, I'm her guy. She comes to Canada.
Thank you.
I'm her guy. But don't tell my wife that, Jeremy. But without being partisan about it, I think it's just empirically true that the relationship that the Canadian people had with the prior administration was quite a bit different from the one that they have with the current administration. And that has been a surprise. And as I say, the alcohol content in your beer. I will also say, though, I came here thinking that this was a great job, that I was incredibly excited to be here. But another surprise is, and this is the truth, it has been much better than even I anticipated. One other thing I can add to this is, when I came here, the one reservation that I had was that I was coming to the place in the world that was the most like the United States. It's not the same, and I understand it's not the same, but I think it's fair to say that there is no place that is as much like the United States. You watch our TV, and we have many shared values. And I would think to myself, gee, if I was going to Morocco or I was going to Indonesia, I'd, you know, new food, new culture, new this, new that. And in fact, that coming here, and really because of the closeness, that it has been a much richer experience for me and for my whole family. Because, as I always say, I get your jokes. That and but seriously, I can be here and I can be having this conversation, and I'm not going to have to struggle to understand the nuance of it. That as much as I am humanly capable of understanding what's in your head when you speak to me, that I don't have this barrier between us. And if I had been almost anywhere else in the world, maybe anywhere else in the world, but certainly, you know, I can think of maybe two other places where you could give me an argument on this one, but probably not there. That would be harder. And so it has been, to my joy, a great surprise that it's as I said to more than one person, including the President of the United States, I have the best job in the United States government. I think he wants to trade with me sometimes, but it's a good one.
One more, please.
There's a great concern in many quarters about the environmental issues related to the oil sands in Alberta. How do you think this affects the interest in the United States for oil from that source?
As I said during my remarks, there is a balance that has to be struck here. That the United States has a critical need for safe and secure sources of energy. There is no place that is a safer and more secure source of energy than Canada. But there is a problem with the environmental footprint of the oil sands. Okay? It's just true. I have said this in Alberta. I have said it to people who run oil sands companies. I will not shy away from it, that there is a problem and that they need to do more. They've already done a lot. And I've been there. I've seen it. I've seen what they do. They have made great strides in the last 15, 17 years. It is a new technology, and they will continue to make great strides. But they have to do more, and I believe very strongly that they have to do more not because people make them do more, but because they want to do more, because they understand that they have children, they have grandchildren, they have to be good stewards of our environment. And it is not up to the United States to tell Canadians what to do. You know, that's your call. but we are your by far and away largest customer, not just for everything in general, but the oil from the oil sands in particular. And as somebody once said to me, the customer is always right. But if you want to be favorably received south of the border with respect to the oil sands, I think that what's necessary is that the people who are responsible for it, and the government in Alberta and the government in Ottawa, has to ensure that you're doing everything that you can and maybe just a little bit more to be responsible stewards of the environment. But again, there's a balance that needs to be struck. It is not binary. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to call on. I'm going to call on Dean Manfredi, but I have to say before I step down that the true test of every good talk is to make us think about things and to ask questions. And I am going to leave here and find out what the differential level of fortification in Cheerios is. I'm absolutely committed to finding out the answer to this. Are we more or less robust? Chris, thanks.
Ambassador, thank you very much for a terrific talk and for coming and honoring us with your presence. On behalf of McGill University and the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I want to thank you, and we look forward to welcoming you here in a few more months. Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks all for being here. Merci beaucoup. I invite you now to come and have a drink at our reception, which will be held just outside of the ballroom. Thanks again.